Young girl, get out of my mind. All the fear is way out of line. Better run, girl, you're much too young, girl.
Ew, get off of me. Oh, I'm F.
Hi, I'm Kirk Kernett.
And I'm Robert Trogdon.
And welcome to another episode of
Master of the 40.
This is a podcast devoted to the short stories of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Brought to you by Geritol, a high-potency vitamin, iron-rich tonic to help you feel stronger.
This is our first episode of 2021.
The holidays got in the way a little bit.
Start of a new semester is always troublesome.
And we had some other unforeseen issues, a little bout with COVID. Happy to say that I am alive. So we figured it was a great time to kick off 2021 with an episode on a short story that is historically important for Fitzgerald, but has never really gotten any attention. So, Robert, why don't you introduce the story? And you actually have a theory about why this particular short story from 1929 has received absolutely no critical attention.
It is another Saturday Evening Post story, At Your Age, which was published in the 17 August 1929 issue. To set up the importance is that this is the story that got Fitzgerald his raise to $4,000 story. And so this inadvertently inspired the title of this wonderful podcast, because this is where Fitzgerald wrote to Hemingway that the Post now pays him $4,000 a screw, but only because he had mastered the 40 positions. But this story is completely ignored in the literature. In my search of all of the academic databases, there are no articles that discuss this story. It was not collected in Tapsett Revelry, Fitzgerald's last collection. Malcolm Cowley did not collect it in the short stories. It was first collected by Bruckley in The Price is High, and then subsequently in his Scribner's edition of the short stories of Scott Fitzgerald, a new collection. But other than that, and its appearance in Great Modern Short Stories for the Modern Library in 1930 and in Jim West's Cambridge edition, it has not been reprinted anywhere.
As we've said before, That Price Was High, I think, came out in 1979. So you're talking 50 years of unavailability. And even a decade later, when Bruckley brought out the, what up until the Cambridge editions were completed, was the
right
kind of key anthology of Bruckley had basically established the canon with that book in 1989. At Your Age was by that point a senior citizen. It was 65 years old or 60 years old. And it's interesting that this would be the story that got him 4,000, because 1928, 29, 30 was actually very much the peak, I think, of Fitzgerald's story writing career. But weirdly enough, I think Harold Ober had something to do with that, because he wrote Fitzgerald when he read this story, said, "This is your best one you've ever done." And Fitzgerald clearly did not agree with that, because he kind of moved on very quickly after cashing the check for this story.
And he's the one who made a big deal to Ober. It's like, if you like it so much, you know, he cast it all on Ober, not on himself.
Right.
That you know, do whatever you can to get the money. And part of the disdain for this is the fact that he did not collect it in Tapsett Revelry in 1935. Yeah. But then I thought about it, and we're talking about a group of Fitzgerald had stories from 1925 up to 1935 for possible inclusion in that collection. And Yeah, that's he just has way too many stories.
Yeah.
Got a call. I mean, you have a selection of Basil stories, but he doesn't include all of the Basil Duke Lee stories. He doesn't include the bowl.
Doesn't include there's a few Josephine stories in there too.
Right.
But you know, At Your Age is a way better story than some of the stuff that's in Taps at Reveille. I mean, if you read what I think of as a fairly minor story, The Fiend.
Yes.
Or
Night Before Chancellorsville. Yes. I mean, it's just, it's a good story, and why it's excluded is kind of up in the air. Bruckley also kind of dismisses it.
Yeah.
And The Price Was High, calling it a commercial story. He's like, one of Fitzgerald's commercial stories.
The worst thing you can call a short story, a commercial story.
And to me, that doesn't make sense, because if by that definition, all of Fitzgerald's stories are commercial stories, because...
Yeah, Babylon Revisited was a commercial story.
Right. I mean, he has to sell them in order to keep up his lifestyle. This is what he does for a living.
You mentioned the collection that came out in 1930 called Modern Short Stories that was edited by Grant Overton. And it is fascinating to me that in that book, which was published by the Modern Library, that Overton selected At Your Age. Of all of the stories, a decade's worth of stories that he had of Fitzgerald's available, going back to Bernice Bobser Hare, or as recently in 1929 is the same year as Last of the Bells or The Swimmers or any of the Basil stories that you mentioned. So he has that story representing Fitzgerald alongside Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, D.H. Lawrence's The Prussian Officer, Catherine Mansfield's Miss Brill, Willa Cather's Paul's Case, and Hemingway's 3 Day Blow. Now, with the possible exception of 3 Day Blow, all of those stories I just mentioned are canonical. They were canonical in 1930. They were classic short stories.
Right.
So there was something about At Your Age that seemed representative, I think, to Grant Overton and the Modern Library that made that story the one that they decided to select and put in there. I think if you read this story in there, you would not think that it was any worse or any better than any of those classic ones. In fact, I will be honest, Three-Day Blow is not one of my favorite Hemingway stories. So
I think Three-Day Blow only works if you have the end of something with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the only way that story works.
Yeah.
Because you don't know the situation in the story unless you've read the first one.
Yeah, there just seems a lot of wheel spinning in 3 Day Blow for me, that it never goes anywhere. Another thing I might mention too, to give you the idea of that this story had a bit of an afterlife after 1929, is in 1936, there was a book called Forward to Fiction that analyzed basic elements of fiction, point of view, story structure. And in there, At Your Age is one of the four case studies that is used alongside Cather's Paul's Case, Somerset Maugham's The Letter, and John Galsworthy's The Apple Tree. Now, I haven't read the last two, but Paul's Case is a fantastic short story, and it's one that I think probably deeply influenced Fitzgerald, but that was originally published around 1912. So that's a story that's already long in the tooth by 1936. So there was something about At Your Age that appealed, I think, to readers underground, to some of the critics. I do think it's a very well-constructed story and has a lot of really effective use of atmosphere or setting, using the winter of Minneapolis and St. Paul in a way to kind of convey the, if you want to call it, the winter of life. So what's your reactions to it? Do you think it's a good story, Robert?
I think it's a good story. It's a very strange Fitzgerald story in that it's one of those stories. Fitzgerald always seems that he went from 18 to 63 in the space of about 5 years, because in And I'm just going to give like a brief synopsis of the story. The story is focused on a man named Tom Squires, who is 50, who begins a bachelor who sees this beautiful shop girl and sort of becomes, you know, has a desire to be around beauty, youth, and vitality, and begins a relationship, a romantic relationship with a girl who's Annie Laurie.
She's about 30 years younger.
Tom and Annie's mother are of the same generation. And eventually when he sort of realizes that he has more in common with the mother than with the daughter, you know, ends the relationship.
Right.
So as someone who is older than the protagonist in the story and is expressed about his being an old man, as it were, part of me was like, I'm immediately offended because like, it's like 50. I would love to be 50 again.
I think, you know, 50 in 1929 was a way different 50 than it is in 2021. But I do think the very title, At Your Age, is pointing to a theme that was very current in that period of time, which was the idea of what were age-appropriate milestones.
At your age, mama, not your shoe size, maybe we could do the twirl.
You and I were talking before we started recording. You and I share a birthday. I'm exactly 2 years older. So I'm 56. You are 54, a whippersnapper. But, you know, honestly, I don't mentally, emotionally, physically, I don't necessarily feel any different than I did at 34 or 24. I mean, and I should say we're not going to present ourselves as some sort of genetically well-preserved human beings. I mean, I have a head of gray hair at this point, but it raises the question of how does age define us? And I think that's a huge question that starts up in the 20th century. And Fitzgerald was very much tapped into it. And I think one of the prejudices against this story is the idea of age, because there's Fitzgerald was so age conscious. And we've talked before about that moment in Gatsby where all of a sudden Nick Carraway belts out, I'm 30 years old today.
Right.
But we also forget that Dick Diver's downfall comes right when he turns 40. So this notion of what age milestones are supposed to mean, I think, are very relevant to the story. And I think Fitzgerald bought into those. I mean, I think he struggled. When you say he sort of went from 18 to 63, I think part of what happened was he got to a certain point of his life. And I think it was right after he turned 30 in 1926 that he kind of reached forward to some of those milestones to define himself, even though the myth is that he, you know, and Hemingway has a letter about Tender as the Night where he talks about the whiny devil's dance of lost youth.
Yeah, don't whine about your lost youth. And
yeah.
Yeah. Hemingway's a good one to give advice, by the way.
I think a modern reader probably would look at the basic plot of this story and think, do we really need a sort of 1929 version of Philip Roth with an older man seeking rejuvenation through the affection of a young woman? I think that's a huge prejudice that probably contemporary audiences would overcome in that. But that said, I think the story is fascinating for the way that it handles Tom's desire to be around a young woman, and yet his knowledge the whole time that it's BS, that he's not, there's something undignified about it.
Well, he realizes that he's not, you know, the first half of the story, he knows that this is just almost a game, that this is a bit of slumming on his part. And I have to say that there's nothing in the story that implies that he's going to do anything untoward to Anne, that he is not looking to seduce her. He is not looking to have sort of a sexual relationship with her. He just wants to be in the presence of youth and vitality and to sort of feel feel that again. It's only in the second, and he also has a plan of how to break it off, which he goes back on when he goes south. He's going to go to Mexico, and he ends up rescuing this young American woman from a bar, and that seems to spark him to run back to Annie. And he ends up engaged to her, and then ends up breaking it.
You mentioned the doing nothing untoward. In fact, there's a sense of generational chivalry that he embodies, because when he's in Mexico, that young woman that he runs into in the bar is 17 years old, and her drinking companions have abandoned her in Mexico. I mean, she's sitting there three sheets to the wind, clearly vulnerable, and he tells the bartender, tell her friends when they come back she'll be at this hotel, and he basically gets her a hotel room. And that sense of him performing nobly, protecting a young woman, is very much in contrast to his rival in the story, who is the prototypical Brom Bones type rival, Randy.
Like Collis Clay in Tender.
Yeah.
You know, the college boy.
Exactly. A guy named Randy Campbell, who, is basically all out for, I mean, he seems genuinely after Annie Laurie, but there's no sense that it's it seems very much in his case a sort of sexual pursuit. So I think the story in that way presages or foreshadows a little bit that moment in Babylon Revisited where Charlie Wells talks about wishing that he could jump back a generation to when character mattered.
Right.
So there's a ethical notion there. And I think again, the whole idea of what is age appropriate. It's interesting to read these stories generationally, because I think, there was a time where I think I was sort of age obsessed, but maybe once I turned 30, I didn't really think about that a whole lot. But I also think that for those of us who were born in the 60s, the idea of age now this is generational perspective, but it seems much more nebulous than when I look at baby boomers, who I don't want to sound prejudiced against baby boomers, but they seem wholly obsessed with staying young.
Should I say something bad about millennials to balance it out now?
Sure, of course. But, we were children who were latchkey kids at a very young age, and many of us instilled with a sense of responsibility. But at the same time, we came of age, many of us, sort of in the late 80s, early 90s, during the Bush recession, when there weren't a lot of jobs out there. And I think that if you think of the defining, images or movies of maybe our late 20s, movies like Richard Linklater's Slacker or Reality Bites, those are movies about the inability to be adults. And, I think if you look at coming of age fiction in the 1980s, a lot of that is very different from The Catcher in the Rye. You have young people born in the 60s desiring to be adults.
Yeah, there was a sense almost for myself. Now, I think you and I both went to grad school.
Right.
About the same time. And that was, I started my master's program in 1990 and got through in 1996. But it was sort of that thing that you were a bit protected, but it was just a sense of foreboding, because it was the academic job market was not as bad as it is now, but it was pretty bad when we both got out. But a sense of, for quite some time, not sure what I was, if I was going to be able to get a job in this profession.
I went from 87 to 93, and I remember long about 90, 91, being 26, 27, had some jobs between grad and between undergrad and grad, but definitely nothing that was going to be a career or make a living on. And I also had a child. I mean, I became a father at 22. So that was even weirder for me in those years, because here I was living in a $100 a month apartment, taking care of a four or five, six year old, whatever he was at the time, and not really feeling like I was an adult, but at the same time feeling like I had a lot of adult responsibilities. So that sort of uncertainty, I think, it probably is one of the main reasons that you and I both have had the same jobs ever since we were in our late 20s. I mean, I got mine at 28 and I think you got yours at 29, and you know, we've been sitting in the same chairs ever since.
It's a strange, and it's almost like, you know, when did you feel like you were an adult? When did you finally
right.
embrace right. the idea, like, I am mature. I am no longer of this younger generation.
And I still live a lifestyle where I feel there are elements of it. I won't say immature, but it does not seem appropriate for I'm a grandparent at this point, but, and I think that reflects the sort of pressure that we have that comes from two directions. On the one hand, it's a culture that says, be young, pursue youth, stay young mentally, physically, whatever way you can. But at the same time, it's a culture that vilifies, but, you know, it's very critical of people who lack the responsibility or lack the maturity of doing what we are all supposed to do, which is, you know, managing money and staying out of debt, being able to take care of our families, whatever that is. So I think it comes at us from both directions. And, you know, I just think to tie it down to a number, you know, there's the cliche that age is nothing but a number, but yeah, it can be a big number.
It's one of those things. It's you don't really realize that you're old when, like, all of a sudden your knee starts hurting for no apparent reason, just because it does.
Especially when you look at this, I think this is true for Fitzgerald and Hemingway. When you look at how their aging accelerated so much because of alcoholism predominantly, but there were other lifestyle factors in there. You know, you look at a picture of F. Scott Fitzgerald at now, I don't think he ever lost his looks to the degree that that's important. But if you look at a picture of him when he was 40 years old, he looks about 50. And Hemingway, oh my God, Hemingway, you look at a picture of Hemingway at 50 and he looks like he's about 70.
Yeah. After the plane crashes for Hemingway after 53, I mean, his aging accelerates to such a degree.
Fitzgerald undeniably glamorized youth for the first chunk of his career. And I think that did incredible damage to him being taken seriously. And it was probably difficult for a scholar like Brookley, who was deeply invested in promoting the reality that Fitzgerald was a craftsman and a great writer, to read a line like what happens on page 2 of At Your Age, where a character says, with exclamation points, which Fitzgerald always recommended not to use, saying, youth, youth, I want it around me just one more time. And I think that opened up Fitzgerald and this particular story to some prejudices. I mean, it's fascinating to sort of look at how, I mean, you can go through, there's a famous interview that Brookley collected where the title, the headline was, F. Scott Fitzgerald says all women over 35 ought to be murdered. And that's a quote from Zelda, which was kind of poking fun at his public reputation. But the press took it seriously. And even when you look at him at the time when Tender as a Night came out at 37, Time magazine is calling him the perpetual undergraduate and claiming he lives in nightclubs and all this kind of stuff. So,
well, there's almost an interesting way in which Fitzgerald is using Squires almost in this story to comment on his reputation, because the same right below the youth, youth, and I marked this, is like, I don't even know what they talk about, he admitted. They pet. Prominent broker goes to petting party with debutante. What is a petting party? Do they serve refreshments? Well, I have to learn to play a saxophone. It's almost as if Fitzgerald is commenting on his This Side of Paradise, Bernice Bobzer hair type of writing there and making fun of it.
And I actually think it's kind of brave for him at this point when he's 32. But, you know, he's 9 years into a career of fame to reference petting, which is, you know, Melville once said he was going to go down famous as a guy that lived with cannibals. Well, Fitzgerald went down in his own lifetime famous for being the guy that talked about petting parties. That term itself hung around him like an albatross, where you look at even in 1931 when the name escapes me right at the moment, Only Yesterday, an informal history of the 20s, which was a huge nostalgic bestseller at the beginning of the Depression. He links Fitzgerald to petting parties. And so I think it's interesting that he brings that term back up. Part of me wonders biographically if the story wasn't slightly inspired by his relationship with Lois Moran, 1927, the idea of an older man being attracted to, I mean, what's essentially a post-adolescent, a teenager for all, not 16 or 17, thank goodness, but 19 or 20-year-old.
I had not thought about the Lois Moran connection, but it's a good comparison. But
well, and she's important because she becomes Rosemary Hoyt in Tender as the Night. And he has a series of stories in here about another one is Jacob's Ladder, where an older man is drawn toward a younger woman. So I think he was feeling his oats a little bit about that particular relationship, which caused a huge fracture in his marriage with Zelda, who was, to use a Fitzgerald quote, a lovely and worn woman by the age of 27.
Even before Zelda's issues in 1930, her breakdown, the marriage was a fraught one and a very tense one so much of the time. And you can sort of see Fitzgerald's desire for like the affirmation of a younger woman, some level of attention being paid to him by the lovely Lois Moran. And Freud wrote that writers write for money, fame, and the love of beautiful women, that writing sort of functions almost as wish fulfillment. And you could see maybe in this story and in Jacob's Ladder, both. It's been a while since I read Jacob's Ladder, but both of those stories, it's at the end, the protagonist and the girl don't wind up together.
There's a great passage where Tom basically says he identifies more with Annie's mother. And that passage reminds me, there was a great movie in the late 1990s called Guinevere with Stephen Ray from The Crying Game. And Jean Smart, who was one of the designing women, and Sarah Polley was the younger girl that Stephen Ray, middle-aged man, gets involved with. And Jean Smart is her mother. And she gives this just blistering speech about older men, what they want from younger women.
What do you have against women your own age?
Mom, please don't.
Shut up, Harper. Look, I'm smiling. I promise your answer won't hurt my feelings.
I don't have anything against women my age.
Sure you do. I tell you what, I'll tell you my theory, and you just jump in any time. For starters, I don't really think that your young girl predilection has much to do with their firm young flesh. I mean, when someone like you is out with someone like Harper, you must invite all kinds of comparison and ridicule, which can't be much fun for either of you. So, then what is a man of your age doing with my 21-year-old daughter? It'd be easy enough to say you're afraid of mature women, but that's so glib. Afraid of what, exactly? So I kept thinking, and then it hit me. I know exactly what she has that I haven't got. Awe. That's it, isn't it? I mean, no real woman, no woman of experience would ever stand in front of you with awe in her eyes and say, wow, look at that man.
I'll ask you this, just because I think you're maybe 10 or 12 years older than your wife, but how do you feel when you see an older, much older man with a younger woman? And what, in your prejudices, is an appropriate age gap?
Well, it depends a lot on the age of the people.
Yeah.
Sarah is indeed 12 years younger than I am. And so I can't really say anything bad, you know, that. But if it's quite a different thing if the girl is 18 and the man is 40, that's well beyond the pale because of just life experiences. But if the man is 50 and the woman is 30, or if the woman is 50 and the man is 30, that's a bit different because there is like the assumption that there's a level of maturity that a 30-year-old doesn't have that an 18-year-old lacks, perhaps. I'm reminded of a Rita Rudner comedy routine where she talks about that her husband is younger than she is. And she says the idea used to be that you get an older man because they're more mature, but now we realize that men never mature. So just, you know, get a young man.
There is some truth to that. One of the words that Fitzgerald always used in this period, and it was so characteristic of the age, was the idea of vigor. And whether that was sexual vigor or just physical fitness, the idea that a man of 50 would just stand next to somehow a 20-year-old and be able to compete with that notion, or to compete with that youth, to be able to keep up with it, if you want to put it that way. That's what a lot of the cosmetic and a lot of the lifestyle industries of the time was selling people who had been born in the 1870s and 1880s.
Right.
I mean, if you think about it, Tom Squire at 50, if he's 50 in 1929, he was born in 1879.
For this story, I don't understand his attraction to Annie. Fitzgerald, if there's a failure in this story, it is the failure to make Annie stand out from the background. And she just seems sort of a stock young character. And this is a man, Fitzgerald, who is able to write vivid, interesting, memorable female characters. And she just seems like a prop.
It's interesting because at one point, fairly early on, the point of view actually switches to her. And he tries to give a little bit of a characterization of her where it says there were several nice invitations like that from Tom. Sitting beside him, she dozed in the warm shadow of Brahms and thought of Randy Campbell and other romantic nebulosities. Boy, there's a mouthful, romantic nebulosities. Who might appear tomorrow. Feeling casually mellow one afternoon, she deliberately provoked Tom to kiss her on the way home. But she wanted to laugh when he took her hands and told her fervently he was falling in love. I agree. I don't think Annie's any kind of really interesting character in the same way that in this movie Guinevere that Sarah Polley's character is. But I think what Fitzgerald is trying to say is, for a young woman of this age, that the attention, the power over older men to attract older men. And let's face it, Randy Campbell is Dullesville. There's not much there going on other than they go out riding around and drinking. Although ultimately she's willing to stand up Tom in order to do that with somebody her age.
Oh, yeah.
In the way that he failed, he was trying to convey a female character who was young that wanted it both ways, that she wanted to know that she could capture an older man, but she also, it's hinted at, knows that it's ridiculous.
There's an interesting part about how he uses psychology to get this relationship going. And basically, he provokes her mother to put her foot down and say, you cannot see my daughter anymore. And that's what causes Annie to want to see him.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great point, because he manipulates it very much. And he's hesitant to do it because when he first writes the note to the mother saying, I would like to date your daughter. I mean, how often does that happen in this day and age? He rips it up.
Right.
But then he comes back and he writes it and sends it. And the very fact that the mother says no, it's a very curt note. That's what Annie jumps in there and says, oh, yeah, this is going to happen now. So she's in the midst of her own generational revolt. And I think that part of her attraction to him is simply as well that it, you know, gets her kicked out of the junior league at one point in the story.
Does he want too much or does he want too little? Because after he provokes her and they start dating, and it only is like a page before, you know, they begin the relationship. It was Tom now who was vaguely discontented. He had what he wanted, her youth at his side, and he felt that anything further would be a mistake. His liberty was precious to him, and he could offer her only a dozen years before he would be old, but she had become something precious to him, and he perceived that drifting wasn't fair. That's the first time when he decides to end the relationship.
I think you could argue that this is a perfect Saturday Evening Post story because it's very moral. Tom wanting just to have that youth around him, but not going to exploit it or take advantage of it. It's, you could see how George Horace Lorimer would say, okay, this is a story for us, because it's promoting those boundaries and saying, even if Tom ends up looking foolish, he doesn't ruin his life over this relationship.
Right.
And I mean, you and I both probably know a lot of older men who've ruined their lives pursuing younger women for whatever reason.
I don't usually say things like this to girls your age, but when I saw you coming out of school that day,
I think Tom knows he looks foolish, and he knows that he is harming Annie, because being kicked out of the junior league will harm her in the long run. There is sort of the idea that you can forgive her running around with Randy Campbell because that's age appropriate. What's interesting is, to me, is that this is all sparked by the girl in the drugstore, the Scandinavian beauty in the drugstore, but it has to be,
yes,
the youth has to be someone of the same class as himself. It can't be the girl in the drugstore.
And he brings that around brilliantly at the end, because he has Tom go back to the drugstore, ask about this beautiful blonde young late teenager, and learns that she has gone off. She's left this job and she's gone and got married. And he sends her a gift from a dumb admirer, and dumb is the actual word. So it's clear that Tom is still acting on these impulses, trying to pursue youth. And I think a lot of the story's nuances, again, get a little lost because of our sense of Fitzgerald mourning youth. Like the line at the end of the story, this is such a typical Fitzgerald way to end a story. I mean, this is Winter Dreams. This is The Lees of Happiness, which we did in our first episode. He says he had lost the battle against youth in spring, and with his grief paid the penalty for age's unforgivable sin, refusing to die. That's so stereotypically Fitzgerald in a way that maybe does the story just a little bit of disservice in terms of the complexity of motive that he gives Tom.
Yeah, what he wanted was only to break his strong old heart.
This whole conception of staying young and being young. Again, I think it's wrong to blame Fitzgerald, because it was a cultural thing going on at the time. One of the things that I wanted to do here was go over some of the crazy ways that advertising and cosmetics and lifestyle were promoting the idea of staying young. So, Robert, I'd like to quiz you on whether you would do these things in order to stave off the middle age life crisis that you and I are no doubt hurtling toward at 56 and 54 respectively. So late 19th century, there's this doctor named Ilya Mechnikov, and his theory is that aging happens because there is a disharmony in the digestive system. And his response to that is lactic acid, to eat yogurt.
My problem was occasional irregularity.
My commercials didn't convince you.
I am definitely a skeptic.
Y'all thought Jamie Lee and Curtis invented that idea, but it actually goes back a lot further than that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's no problem.
Okay, so there's a guy, another guy, and all these doctors are European. Sergey Voronoff. This gets into endocrinology. He comes up with the idea that the lack of vigor and sexual potency in men is a product of withered glands. So his idea is he's going to do gland transplants, and it's coming from animals. So he gets famous in the 1920s for monkey gland injections.
No. I may like follow Frank Thompson's and Doug Flutie's advice and get testosterone supplements and things like that, but no monkey glands unless you're talking about the cocktail.
Well, actually, it's funny you mention that, because that's exactly where the name of the cocktail came from. And all throughout the 20s and 30s, there are all these funny references to the monkey glands. And it's because this guy was promoting this idea. It actually goes back a little further, even to another doctor called Bonsecard, Charles Bonsecard. And he was using the crushed up testicles of dogs and goats. Imagine shooting yourself full of this stuff. But you know, he claimed it took 30 years off his life. He was 72 at the time. This formula got marketed, and you can find the magazine ads under the name of Spermine. So you can guess the this is almost like the pills that you see advertised on late night television. It's exactly that. All right. So there's another operation. Eugene Steinek comes up with the Steinek operation, which at least two famous guys got this operation, Sigmund Freud and William Butler Yeats. And this is where, I feel like I almost have to sit on a pillow to describe this operation. This is where they would go in and sever the vas deferens, so the sperm stay is not ejaculated I don't need to describe much further, but the idea is that the sperm or the potency stays in the body. Yeats claimed that it was so good that it gave him a second puberty. That was the term he used.
You know, if there's any writer that's seen as more obsessed with youth than Fitzgerald, it's William Butler Yeats.
Definitely. And he very much tied his notion of, I think he was in his late 60s, early 70s when he had that operation. Okay, just some more quack ones. Again, a lot of these are kind of hair tonic type things. There was a product called Vitae One that was supposedly an exotic mineral from Mexico. Another called El Zaire that was supposed to cure both baldness and constipation.
Horse pucky, noun. For example, that is just a bunch of horse pucky.
Did you do minerals? Exotic minerals from Mexico?
It depends on the minerals, but I know like some of these patent medicines had like radium in them and things of that nature.
Well, it turned out this was Epsom salt.
Oh, well, that explains the cure for constipation right there.
Yes, exactly.
If you do the yogurt, though, you don't need to do the Epsom salts, apparently.
That's true. That's true. They were competing in the marketplace. Let me ask you this. Would you ever wear a toupee to look young?
No, I do. I don't think I would. I think I would go bald proudly, but No men in my family have been bald, so I've got that to, on my side genetically.
You know, it's interesting because the baldness was a stigma all the way up, and I really think we owe it to African-American men like Michael Jordan to really make that a sign of its own kind of masculinity. So toupees seem really out of fashion in this day and age. And I think, we all used to joke about how fake they looked. So I don't think those are ones that would go over very well either.
Well, we still have Rogaine, though. I mean, we still get like that.
That's true. And the Hair Club for Men, that guy just passed away. Mm. Okay. So there was a company called P. Presto, which sounds legit. Their ad said, "Stop growing old, send away for $2 for this booklet." And they would send you illustrations on how to stretch the scrotum and testicles for blood and nerve supply. And
It is a great shame that this is just an audio podcast because the look on my face is just amazing right now.
Oh, I thought you were wanting to see the pictures. I'm like, no, I do not
want to. I don't want to see the pictures of scrotum stretching. No. 1,000 times no.
The guy that ran this company was named Edward F. Lee, and he was actually charged in 1919, believe it or not, with fraud and ended up losing. Would you ever get Botox?
I don't think I would. I mean, it's not out of any sense of fear for it, but it's just the wrinkles are happening. They're going to happen. I'm going for that whole, like, you look distinguished look anyway, if possible.
Actually, facelifts became very popular in the 1920s. Would you ever get a facelift?
Yeah, I mean, it's just I have no fear of it. I mean, I think I'd have a tummy tuck, though, more so, or buttock augmentation or something like that.
You,
I'm going to put some junk in my trunk.
Yeah, get the. Now you got to be very careful with that because people have died from getting the balloons in the rear or whatever they call it. So we joke around about the weird remedies, whether they're surgical or cosmetic for aging. But I think the thing to emphasize is that, Fitzgerald wrote in a world that was promoting that. He was by no means idiosyncratic in his fixation with youth. It may stand out in a literary context, but in a cultural context, he was exploring a lot of those same issues about staying young and staying vibrant. I think the difference is he always knew that lost youth was sort of a resonant touchstone of nostalgia for him. And he kind of made a thing of losing his youth from the time he was a teenager on.
Right. And I think part of that also is you can see that it becomes a trap.
Yeah.
And I think Fitzgerald recognized in a way, especially in the 30s, that it was a trap.
Yeah.
I think that's, you see the movement to him trying, historical fiction and other approaches to get out of that.
I do think in Tender as the Night, that's probably where he felt the trap most, because so much of that is about Dick Diver, who's supposed to be suffering this great historical displacement, where he was somebody before the war that was primed to be a brilliant psychoanalysis. And Fitzgerald keeps inscribing it in terms of losing his youth. And this story really connects a lot of ways, Tom Squire, because Dick Diver feels embarrassed by his own attraction early on to Rosemary. But as he descends, he pursues it more and more. And interestingly enough, Rosemary in that novel is allowed to grow up and become an adult woman. Whereas Annie, I mean, we're in a short story, so we have a tighter span of time. But she's an adult by the end of it. And it's interesting and tender because Dick says, after his last encounter with Rosemary, she never grew up, which is his projection.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. Because the women in that novel are so much more advanced than the male characters are.
And that's maybe the note we want to end the analysis on, is that generationally, we are probably beyond the idea of storylines about older men pursuing younger women. I mean, I just think in this day and age that it's been played out and it's tired, but it still doesn't solve the problem of aging and the pressure we all feel, I think, to stay young. Ultimately, on the scale of 1 to 10 Zeldas, where would you put the story, Robert?
I would say it's a good 7.5 to possibly 8 Zeldas.
Yeah.
And it's really the lack of strong characterization for Annie that undercuts it for me.
I agree completely. I'd probably go with an 8. I think in terms, again, of just line-by-line writing, I think it's beautiful, beautifully done. I think the characterization of Tom is very nuanced. As I mentioned before, I think the evocation of the Minnesota winter and the way that that plays in with his feelings of being kind of a lion in winter is really well done. But I agree that I don't like the lines like youth, youth, I want it all around me one more time. That seems a little silly.
There's not the bad writing that was in Gretchen's 40 Winks.
No, there's not. And again, I would just emphasize, I think we want to just state that probably his peak story writing years were 1928 through 1931, to where he could crank out these very nuanced stories. I mean, he's doing basically 2 stories a month.
Yeah.
So we're, 7.58. The other thing we always have to do is reach back and pull out the next story that we're going to do. And, okay. Well, this will be a good one. This will be a very serious one. We're looking at The Lost Decade.
Ooh.
Another gem very worthy of discovery. Well, happy 2021, Robert.
Happy 2021 to you, and I'm glad you are on the road to recovery.
Well, thank you. I do not recommend COVID for anybody out there. Please do wear a mask. I'm wearing 2, even though I probably have antibodies now.
Have you tried monkey glands for recovery?
I'm headed right now to get an injection. So if the next time, if I happen to eat a banana and hang upside down off my desk while we record this, please forgive me. So until next time.
All right. Take care. This is Master of the 40.
Beneath your perfume. Just a baby in disguise. And though you know